deals with the situation where there is a motion to amend a civil pleading to add a claim for punitive damages. We've had a couple work sessions on this bill, and it was the committee's concern that the timelines in the House version of the bill may present some logistical problems. The Dash A5 amendments that you should have before you are a complete gut and stuff of the House version of the bill, but essentially address the same problem. And what they do is they allow the court to consider when a motion for to amend for punitive damages is made currently, the court basically, as long as the motion meets the basic requirements, has to grant the motion irrespective of whether it causes the defending party any prejudice. The Dash A5 amendments would allow the court to consider the issue of prejudice. It also gives the court the ability to continue the if the motion is made at a late date and there's no more opportunity for discovery, the court could continue the matter or the trial to allow discovery to take place. That discovery could address either the motion itself or the defense against the punitive damages claim itself. I believe that these are now consensus amendments.
All right, Senator Ringo.
Mr. Chair, just I really appreciate our committee counsel's assistance in working this out, because in my opinion, there was a legitimate problem with the current situation, and so it did make sense to address it. I do want to clarify, at least it's my opinion, that with these amendments, an amendment to allow punitive damages would fall into the same analysis that occurs under ORCP 23A. Do you agree with that, Bill?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo. I do agree with that. We did have a discussion about possibly placing the motion to amend for punitive damages in the ORCP under 23, but there was some concern about case law that's currently in existence that interprets the statute dealing with the punitive damage amendment, and also there was some concern about the giving the Council on Court Procedures, despite their good work on other things, the control to change the punitive damages amendment rules, which obviously, given this, the number of hearings that we've had on this bill alone, are subject of legislative concern, and we wanted to keep the purview of the legislature on that issue for now.
Right. Well, Mr. Chair, again, I appreciate the work of the council, and we are in work session. And
yes,
I move,
we are.
I move the Dash 5 amendments.
Thank you. Senator Ringo moves the adoption of the
question, Mr. Chairman.
Dash A5 amendments. Discussion. Senator Farrelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a procedural question.
Sure. Go ahead.
This bill was brought by Representative Ackerman. Was it Representative Ackerman consulted on the Gavin staff?
Not to my knowledge. Although I saw him last night, he didn't say anything about it. So.
Did he know about it?
Senator Farrelly, I did not consult Representative Ackerman on that one. To my knowledge, since the House hearings, he's not been that involved in the bill. Rather, it's been the proponents, John Kemp from my firm, myself, OTLA folks, Senator Ringo, and Senator Walker, who's been most involved. So.
And just then, the procedure from here would be assumed passage in the Senate and the Conference Committee.
Well, I don't think that you're going to see a conference committee on this. I think this will be fine. I don't think that'll take a trip to the Ackerman's going to disagree with the compromise that Senator Ringo worked out.
Yeah, I think it's the objective that's met, perhaps in a different procedure.
Right.
I'm fine with that.
All right. Further discussion, Senator Walker.
Am I out to breakfast, or we're talking about 2049?
Right.
Well, Representative Ackerman's name is not on this bill.
I was reviewing the Measure Summer. He was the previous carrier.
Well, he was the guy that got stuck
just
with
the carrier.
It.
Right.
Yeah. But it was a bill printed by the Joint Interim Committee on Judiciary, or not printed by them, but recommended by them.
Right. So the.
So I don't think he has anything to do with it.
Who chaired that?
Max Williams, I believe.
Okay. Just the idea that a total replacement sometimes causes hard work.
Yeah, I know.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sometimes.
Okay, further discussion on the motion. Any objection to the motion? No objection. The motion passes. Senator Ringo.
Mr. Chair, move 2049 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Ringo moves House Bill 2049 as amended for the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Motion passed. Senator Ringo, would you be kind enough to carry that for me?
Yes, please.
All right, work session 620, Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, House Bill 620 is, you should have before you dash one amendments. As I understand it, is again a complete gut and stuff of the bill. The dash one amendments deal with the situation of when you are entitled to receive attorney's fees in a workers' comp case. It's my understanding that the folks from OTLA have someone who can better explain the amendments to us.
Actually, Senator Walker, is your amendments, I believe.
Senate Bill 620.
Should be the dash one, Senator.
Yes.
Does this representative bill is somehow locked up? Or
yes, I believe this is
in transit or
Senate Bill 563, and it is locked up. And this chamber, I believe, passed this bill unanimously before. One no vote, two no votes. Okay, thank you. Put my glasses.
They
on.
Just didn't understand the situation.
Yeah, that's exactly right. But this allows attorney fees to workers' comp attorneys who represent their clients in appeal cases on medical issues. And these clients do not normally get representation because the attorneys don't get paid. It's quite an unfair system. This was something worked out with all of the parties. Liberty Northwest is on board. They're right there in the front row with Sean Miller.
Sean represents Liberty?
Yes, he does. Sometimes I think he was sorry, too, when he had to come into my office. But anyway, that's what we're doing here.
All right. We're in work session. Senator Walker, you want to move your amendments?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendments to Senate Bill, where are we?
620. Senator Walker moves the adoption of the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 620. Discussion on the motion beyond what Senator Walker suggested. There is no further discussion. Any objection to the motion? There is no objection. Passes, Senator Walker.
And, Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 620 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation, but still hoping that we might get Senate Bill 563 moving on my House side.
Senator Walker moves Senate Bill 620 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation and no sniffling. Any further discussion on the motion? Any objection to the motion? Passing. Senator Walker, you can carry your fine piece of legislation here.
Thank you.
All right.
There's too much paperwork here this morning.
You never actually issued a formal dashboard. Is that right? Before we do that, let's move on to the we do a public hearing on House Bill 2235, and we've got a sign up sheet for that place. Should be quick.
Yeah.
All right, Scott. I'm good at butchering your name. Just and company and all others. Quickly, I understand this is a technical fix to the statute we passed last session.
I'm sorry to hear you.
This is a technical fix to the statute we passed last session, right? Yes, no, maybe?
Chairman, that is correct. Right. There's several fixes here.
All right. What are they?
Okay. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Tai, and I'm the director of the Standards and Certification Division for the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. And with me is Harold Burke Sievers.
Yeah, I'm chair of the Private Security Advisory Committee and also a board member of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training.
Okay.
Chairman, as briefly, and members of the committee, briefly, I have written testimony, so I'll just highlight the major points of what this bill will do.
Okay.
First, this bill will require a notice to the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training if a person has been arrested and charged with a crime. Currently, not all persons that are in the private security industry are required to make that notification to the department. We feel it's important for the integrity of the industry that anybody that's related or works within the private security industry it would be required to report being charged with a crime within 48 hours to the department. And this would include those employees that would be working on a temporary work permit. The second component of this bill would close a loophole that was created in the 2001 session where the law was modified and we had a crowd management group moved out of one area of the statute and placed in another. With that movement, it created a loophole where for those employees that wear a uniform or something with a company name, they would not fall under the act because they weren't exercising arrest powers or containment powers. We would like to close that loophole so that if you work for, say, a department store and you're undercover and you detect somebody that would be, say, shoplifting, that person would now fall under the act because they're not wearing a uniform. However, they are acting in the interest of the companies. The third change would tighten up the exemptions for specific groups that work related to the private security industry. The best example I can give you is you have a technician that installs alarm monitor systems in a home. While they're installing that alarm monitoring system, they would be exempt from having to be certified as a private security provider. However, if they were employed in another aspect by the company where they actually do alarm monitoring, then they would be required to get certification as a private security provider. So there's a list of occupations where while you're performing the duty as a lawyer or as installing alarm monitors, you would be exempt from the act. However, if you're working for a private security provider, providing private security services, then you would have to get a certification. Next, this bill would modify the structure of the Private Security Advisory Committee. It would allow them to be a policy committee and have the same status as other policy committees within the department and the board. Fifth, this would remove from statute set test score for firearms testing and allow the department to establish and set the scoring requirements by administrative rule rather than in statute. And the final element of this bill would clarify the definition of what an executive manager is versus a proprietary manager or contract manager. That's the general gist of what we're asking in these amendments. Okay. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Committee, any questions? Senator Ringo.
This whole issue is kind of new to me, but are you telling me that security companies have to be licensed and certified by the state?
Chairman, Senator Ringo, that is correct.
But let's say I just wanted to hire somebody to stand outside of my office. I can't do that. They have to have some sort of license to do that.
Chairman, Senator Ringo, depending on what type of specific duties you would be assigning that person would determine whether that person needs to get a certification. For instance, if you are assigning that person to guard your property and premises against theft or entry by individuals who you don't want to enter your establishment, then yes, they would have to get a certification.
Yeah. And that person would have to have a certain amount of training.
Chairman, Senator Ringo, yes, that's correct. It would require that person, if he's unarmed, would require 8 hours of classroom training and then a 4-hour actual field assessment.
I see. Thank you.
Any other questions? Another question. Work session.
Sure.
Senator Burdy.
This bill has authority. I'm trying to look at its number here.
2235.
2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235. 2235
Senator Burdick moves House Bill 2235 A before the Senate do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none. So ordered. Senator Starr, would you carry that for me?
I'll do it.
Thank you, sir. Dan Representative Prozanski here. Floyd, you're here on 27-70. Oh, we're changing counts. Okay. Craig.
Yes.
Fill us in here.
Mr. Chairman, while Representative Prozanski is getting seated, House Bill 2770 is before you with the A13 amendments, and Patsy hand engrossed this. It says A12 and A13, but what you've got is the bill engrossed with the A13 amendments. Briefly, I'll go through it because before Mr. Representative Prozanski gets up here. Section 2 is a new crime of strangulation, and when it came out of the House, it had a Class C felony component, which has been removed. Does everyone have the A engrossed version before I start rattling things off?
Mm-hmm. The hand engrossed?
Hand engrossed, excuse me.
Yes, we do. I've got mine.
Okay. So that's the strangulation bill, which I believe Representative Prozanski is here for. Section 3 just places that in the domestic violence evidence code. Section 4 is also allows for a civil action if someone commits strangulation against an elderly or incapacitated person. Again, just placing it with like crimes, which is the same with Section 5 and Section 6 and 7, treating this as other misdemeanor crimes involving violence or domestic violence crimes. Section 8 as well, again, making it treated like those other domestic violence crimes. Section 9 is Julie Brandis had in Senate Bill 466, the metal underpants bill, I believe is what it's affectionately known as. That Section 10 and 11 are technical sections related to that crime. Which brings us to Section 12, which is Section 12 is the crime of impersonating a public servant, and there's been some people have been having some problems, some law enforcement officers have been problems with pulling people over who are driving police cars or what look like police cars. They're dressed in uniform, but there's been a problem with whether they are have an intent to defraud, which is usually financial, or if they're obtaining a benefit. So this would add the term with the intent to deceive to that. And if you have any questions, Bill Cross and Doug Brown are here to answer questions on that. Section 13.
Mr. Chair, so counsel, this is not just a Halloween prank?
No.
Dressing up on Halloween?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Walker, it's not. It's a situation where usually it's a male, dresses up as a police officer, drives a police car, pulls women over, doesn't commit a crime, doesn't attempt to commit a crime, but is doing that to deceive them and to basically take power over them. That's what they enjoy that. Doug Brown is here. He's a trooper also. He's a trooper and an attorney. So what a scary, scary combination. If you have any questions, he could answer those. The issue was more again, with the state of mind, including an intent to deceive. You don't have to jump through the hoops of intent to defraud, whether taking money or deriving a benefit. Some people have looked at that and been confused as to whether such a fact pattern would be actionable under that section. Section 13 is the section that deals with body wires that we dealt with last section, and it's a cleanup in that. In Section 9, which is on page 15 of the hand engrossed bill, in Section 9 it covers whom a law enforcement officer can divulge the contents of a body wire to when they have probable cause and they wear a body wire. And that was last session, we allowed that to be used in prostitution cases. Prostitution is a misdemeanor, and I believe the testimony was that the body wires were allowed because the decoy officer is in a very vulnerable position, standing out on, in my when I used to prosecute, they'd usually be out on Sandy or 82nd, and they wanted to have a body wire so they could ask for cover if they needed it. The problem was when they're enforcing prostitution, the old language said you could only divulge the contents of that body wire to someone who's enforcing felonies. And so we changed that to enforcement of the criminal laws of this state of the United States. And Section 14 is another cleanup where a police officer arrests a probationer on the grounds that they violated their probation. They can then hold that person in detention for 36 hours based upon a statement. But the way the statute reads, it says a statement by the probation officer. The amendment would allow either the arresting officer or the probation officer to fill out this statement. And again, this is to fix a problem where, say, a person is arrested for violating new crimes, which would clearly be a probation violation. It avoids a problem where the police officer has to find this probation officer by, the next morning when it's sometimes difficult to do so. That's the last section.
All right.
Mr. Chair?
Yes,
Senator
Walker.
Amazing what you can do with a relating clause relating to crime.
Amazing what you can do when you have talent and skill. Yes.
So I'm fascinated by what's in this bill.
I'm surprised we screwed up the body wire bill last session.
That was quite a controversial bill. I recall that. I ended up supporting that, I believe.
Mea culpa.
And the strangulation bill was something I introduced last session but couldn't get a hearing on, so I'm glad to see Representative Kozanski was able to pull that off.
Floyd, you're happy with all of this so far?
Yes.
Representative Floyd Kozanski,
excuse me. Mr. Chair and Senators, I am. I guess what I'd like to do, since we have, I guess this is one of our Christmas and June bills that has numerous ornaments. Apparently, I think we have five or six. And what I'd like to do, if it would be appropriate, is to have breakouts for the different supporters of the different components as you need to have questions answered.
Actually, I'm just ready to move the bill.
Let's do it.
Unless there's somebody that's, wants to talk a lot. I'm kind of in a funny mood today. I don't know what to deal with. It's like a talk show host, it's like I need a cup of coffee or something.
Mr. Chair?
Send her a ringer.
I guess I would like to ask some questions, if I may.
Okay, go ahead.
What's the rationale for the creating a crime of strangulation?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, the reason that we think it's important is because of the type of conduct that's involved there is one that puts usually women at great risk, and we feel that this is a means of being able to, one, have education as to the conduct itself, as well as what we want to be able to do in this particular bill. Leaving it as a misdemeanor is for really two reasons. Number one, the fiscal, when it came out of the House side, was astronomical. We did not believe that it was going to be that much because it actually had enhancements of felony based on certain additional conduct. What we have discussed with Phil Lemon of the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission, is that by having this as a misdemeanor, we'll be able to track to see what type of impact it would have for felony treatment in the future. I have three individuals that are here, two of them are the district attorney's offices, Mike Dugan, who's the DA from Deschutes County, and Gene McCunkle, who's with Marion County. Gene and I have worked with a task group that's part of a group from the attorney general's office on the strangulation, and if you want more particulars, I'd like to have them come up to answer your questions.
Mr. Chair, I guess my question is, isn't this already assault?
Well, it could be assault if you actually have injury that actually does, in fact, occur to the point of where you can, and the concern for prosecutors is being able to plead and prove the assault where there's that physical injury. This actually would allow for evidence to go forward where you would not have to actually prove to that level that you would for in an assault. And I will defer.
Mr. Chair, just sure. I mean, I would think that the interruption of blood flow or air circulation is injury.
The definition of physical injury under the Criminal Code, Senator Ringo, and
Senator Minnesota.
And who are you?
Committee of Physical Impairment.
Who are you?
Oh, I'm sorry. Jean Kunkel from Marion County VA's office.
Thank you.
The technical definition of physical injury under the criminal code is either substantial impairment, impairment of physical condition, or substantial pain. And the problem with strangulation cases is sometimes it can cause a great deal of injury, like the small bones in the neck can be broken, or there can be a lingering inability to speak, raspy voice, but sometimes it doesn't cause any injury. And so part of the problem is there's an inconsistency among counties in Oregon. Sometimes if you can't prove that injury, these are being charged as harassments. Sometimes they're being charged as menacings, but that focuses on the mental state of the defendant and not his actions. Sometimes if they're if you have some evidence of physical injury and you have some statements from the victim that she either passed out or that she lost her bodily functions, you can charge them as attempted assault too. That's very rare. And so one of the reasons that we would like this bill is because of a lot of times the fact that there is no physical injury, the inability to prove the physical injury if there is, consistency, and the fact that basically strangulation can be very lethal conduct. And we'd like that to be reflected on their criminal history. But that's what their conduct
was. Mr. Chair, just a comment. I mean, I can't believe that it doesn't, I mean, even if, under your definition, I can't believe it doesn't constitute physical injury. I mean, if you think the bill is needed, I'm not going to get in the way. It seems to me we're going down the road. We're going to need to create a crime of hitting somebody with a baseball bat's a crime. If hitting them with a tire iron is a separate crime. Hitting them with another heavy object is another crime. I don't think we need to do this. But if you think we do, then I'm a yes.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ringo, we do. We wouldn't be any for you. And I'll leave it at this. When you get in front of a jury of 6 or 12 individuals and you need to actually be able to prove the physical injury component, it's very difficult and many times in these type of cases to actually get them to understand because they can't physically see the result of the injury. And for whatever reason, the statements that are made by the victim are not always as compelling as they need to be.
Right. I mean, I defer to this.
Well, the other thing you got to remember is in a criminal trial, the argument by the defense is reasonable doubt. Because if there's a reasonable doubt that it didn't occur, then you can't convict him. I think there's a famous statement from the O.J. Simpson trial by a particular lawyer that says something very similar. And that's really the issue. In criminal trials, that's what's argued. Is there a reasonable doubt? So if the statutory construct doesn't speak directly to the actual actions of the defendant, then it creates a plausible argument for the defense. And that's part of what's trying to be addressed here.
Mr. Chairman, I think there's another point that we can't forget, which this bill would seem to create even another crime, which is strangulation by mental underpants.
Thank you, Senator Burdick.
We
knew somehow this was going to come up.
Okay, we're in work session. Senator Burdick is moving the dash 13 amendments to House Bill 2770.
Don't we want the dash 12 amendments?
It's just the 13 supersedes.
13. Okay, thank you for moving that. Any discussion on the amendments? No discussion. Any objection? Motion passes. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. All right. Senator Breed.
I move House Bill 2772 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation, and I beg not to carry it.
All right. Senator Burdick moves House Bill 2770 is amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? She begs not to carry it, of course. Discussion? Any objections? There are no objections. Motion passes, and I will carry this bill.
I had my metal underpants speech already prepared, so you can borrow it if you want.
Mr. Chairman, I have to warn you, you're likely to make page one of the Weekly Democrat.
Great. In trying to identify gifts for the committee, I tried to find some metal underpants for Senator Walker, but there are neighborhoods I dare not go into. So.
Thank you. I'm glad you weren't able to do that.
All right. I seem to have lost my agenda. I filed it somewhere, so what am I doing here? Yes. Let's do 3330. This should be a relatively quick bill. What do we have on that?
We have nobody signed up.
No one signed up. Council, what's this bill?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 3330A authorizes the governor to proclaim that a natural disaster act of war occurred. Essentially, if I'm not mistaken, I thought we actually heard public testimony on this bill. So the issue is people are killed in a disaster, be it natural or man-made. You cannot locate the body. There are survivors who need to be able to get access to insurance and other proceeds to finish up their affairs. The dash A4s are in front of you. As I understand it, the dash A4s just clear up a technical issue with respect to who issues the death certificate so that that can be taken care of as efficiently as possible. So nobody signed up, as I see, and the bill should be ready to go forward.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Walker.
You had a question that I thought was a good one. Man, I've got so many copies.
It was an excellent question. However, they decided to just leave it hanging for this session.
Okay. So you know exactly what that is.
I do. And so we decided that it would be okay because of the likelihood of
that happening.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. And,
right. All right.
Okay.
Work
just,
session.
You know, following my...
3330.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Brady.
I move the dash 4 amendments to House Bill 3330.
Senator Brady moves the adoption of the A4 amendment to House Bill 3330. Discussion?
Don't need the dash A3.
One to A4.
Okay, got it.
A4. Discussion? Any objection? Hearing none. So ordered. Senator Brady.
Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill 3330 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Verdict goes House Bill 3330 is amended to the floor of the Senate with a new pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? Hearing none. So order motion. Pass the Senator.
I will, Mr. Chair.
Okay. I still haven't found my agenda, by the way. I buried it here somewhere. I just don't know what to do. $26.96. Have we heard this before?
I don't recall. I don't believe so.
Okay. We're a little bit.
I'll summarize it for you. If it sounds familiar, just stop me.
We have it.
House Bill.
Good pass. Let's give it a public hearing. Don't we have it?
Yeah. House Bill 2696A provides a right when DHS cuts off certain types of public assistance. It provides the right for a hearing for the public assistance person. The dash A3 amendments that you have deal with the issue of participation in job opportunity and basic skill programs.
All right. I've just been lobbied ad nauseum on this thing. That's what the deal is. Who is the proponent of this bill?
Martin Taylor.
That's the guy. He's been chasing me around, following me around, stalking me for guys. Martin, come up and chat with us briefly.
Is there any strangulation?
No strangulation yet. I've resisted.
Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Martin Taylor. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Law Center, and I resort to arm twisting in time to time, but strangulation I haven't resorted to yet. So. You know, you're on such a great flow. I don't want to interrupt that. I'll be very brief, and you can ask questions if you have more. This is a bill that tries to address a situation where people who qualify to be part of Oregon's jobs program, these are generally single mothers with dependent children, receive a benefit from the state, and in a period of time they're expected to perform work activities. In that process, they're eligible to go to the state and ask for what's known as a secondary support service, which might be child care while they're performing work activities. It may be assistance in getting transportation to those activities. And in the current system, that secondary benefit can be denied, and the only recourse is to go through the circuit court and another than contested case hearing, which is happening at great expense. And this simply says, from a maintenance of government standpoint, it makes more sense to have those appeals done at a hearings officer level than through the circuit court process. It puts the appeal back where it belongs, which is in the hearings office. I should say that as a process standpoint, we worked this bill extensively in the House. Representative Williams is one of the chief sponsors of the bill. He helped facilitate conversations with DHS. DHS had some issues with the bill originally, but worked well with us to resolve those issues, and I think we now have a bill in front of you that not only will do some real good for poor people, but also we were able to assess a fiscal that whatever cost there is to the agency will probably be less than the amount that we that we save by not having to go through circuit court and have judgments against the state. So it should be a modest savings to the state in this bill. Questions?
All right. You're the only person that signed up. Lucky you. All right. Work session. Senator Burdick.
I would move the -A3 amendments to 2696.
Okay. Senator Burdick moves the adoption of the A3 amendments to House Bill 2696.
Bless you.
Any further discussion?
Yeah, bless you on this one, too.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Warren.
Well, my conversations with Mr. Taylor in my office indicated this fixed a Huxford case, which was a ruling by the court that said you can't do this. Isn't that right?
I was being concise, but we used to have a system where these were all hearings within a hearings officer panel in Oregon. Then, as an administrative rule, the agency determined that they were going to no longer provide a hearings officer process.
Okay.
There's still an appeal right. Those appeals began to go to the circuit court process, and at that time, there was a contest to whether or not the state could actually deny a hearings office process, and that case was known as the Huxford case, and the Huxford case concluded that the state did have that right. So in order to put this back into a hearings office, you need statutory fix.
All right. Any further discussion on the motion to adopt the amendment? None? Any objections? Motion passes.
Chairman,
Senator Burdick.
I move House Bill 2696 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick moves House Bill 2696 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? No objections. Motion passes. Who's not been assigned a bill? Senator Burdick, this is yours. Senator Burdick will carry this bill. Great. Thank you. Now we're going to move to the fun and exciting topic of insurance. Bill 297, Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. House Bill 297 is a Senate Bill 297 is a complete gut and stuff. You should have -4 amendments in front of you. These amendments deal with the issue of, and I don't believe we have had a hearing on this issue, the issue of when an insured, usually a property owner, has an environmental-related loss, usually some type of pollution discharge on their property. They are then the subject of either agency action or a suit or other notice of a claim. They then make a claim to their insurance carriers. Usually they've had many carriers over a long period of time. The discharge is not discovered for many years and has been ongoing. And then there's a situation where all of the carriers essentially start assuming that they say that there is coverage. They start pointing at each other as who is the appropriate party to start paying for the defense costs, the investigative costs, expert fees, testing costs, all these costs that begin to accrue immediately after notice of the claim. That requires the insured usually to file suit against the insurance companies so that the court can work out who should pay these costs. Often those cases aren't resolved for many years. Meanwhile, the insureds are putting an outlay of funds to cover these costs. This bill essentially tries to shift the procedural situation so that when an insured has such a claim, they can make what's called an all-sums request to their insurance carriers. If the insurance carrier is assuming they admit coverage and it's an all-sums policy, which I'll get into in a minute, the insurance carriers would then be under a duty to start paying for these initial costs or whatever costs are coming in, and then the insurance carriers would have the burden of turning around and figuring out amongst themselves, either in a court process or some kind of out-of-court alternative dispute resolution, what reimbursement they should get for their costs so that the insurance carriers come up with an equal allocation. The bill does provide for the situation where the insured has either lacked insurance for a period of time or was self-insured for a period of time. They would be considered an insurance carrier for purpose of the allocation, so they might actually be required to pay back their own insurance carrier who paid them initially. Bill also limits liability of the insurance carriers to their policy limits and including whatever exclusions they had. The second part of the bill deals with the issue of often these losses happened long ages ago, in the 60s, 50s sometimes. What happens when there is a loss during that time period? The insured only finds out about it in the recent past, and they cannot locate the insurance policy. They believe they had a policy with a certain company, but they just can't find it. The bill states that the insured has a duty to do a diligent investigation to try and find that policy. If they can't, they provide a notice of a loss policy to the insurance carrier or carriers who they thought they had a policy with. Then the carriers must undertake their own investigation to try and locate the policy. The bill sets forth certain burdens of proof as to who the insured has the burden of proving that a policy existed. The insurance company has a burden of proving, if the insured can prove that a policy existed but they can't prove the policy limits, then it's assumed that it's the minimum policy limits. The insured has the burden of proving that. The duty of investigation in the bill is supposed to be reciprocal, so that the insured and the insurance company both have the exact same duty to both cooperate and do the investigation of their files to determine if there is a loss policy or if there was a policy, what its terms are. There is a section that you'll see in the bill that allows the insurance company to claim as an affirmative defense that the insured either did not cooperate in the investigation or somehow otherwise didn't undertake a diligent investigation. So it's a complex bill. I can answer more questions about it. I see in the audience both interested parties on both sides.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Riggins.
Is there any type of sanction imposed if an insurer fails to disclose the presence of an insurance policy?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, I believe that the sanction would be it is an affirmative defense to, let me direct you to the actual language.
It's in Section 4 of the amendments.
What page is that on, Senator Walker?
I handed my copy.
Oh, okay. It's on page 7, line 20. It would be an affirmative defense to the claim, and I'm assuming that the claim refers to the claim of a loss policy.
I guess I was referring to the circumstance where the insurer knows that there's a policy, knows that it has issued a policy, but that insurer fails to disclose that.
If the insurer fails to disclose that there is a policy, just reading through the bill, I do not know if there is a specific sanction for that. Although the bill has certain requirements that the insurance company must undertake. I don't see any particular sanction if the insurance company fails to undertake those requirements, but I mean that's common in many statutes that there are requirements that statutes have, but no particular sanction if they fail to undertake that. I suppose they would be found in contempt of court at the least, and it would be an issue that would probably be before the jury when the jury would decide. Ultimately, the jury would have to decide what are the terms of the loss policy. To the extent that that's a question of fact, and I assume if the insurance company failed to bring forward evidence, it would be as if any other civil case where you didn't produce documents that were subject to a request for production of documents, and that issue would be before the jury and the court for sanctions and the jury's consideration.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, it seems to me the insurance company would essentially be engaged in the practice of lying if they knew of the existence of a policy and didn't disclose it, so that is provided for in the law already.
It will not very much.
Yeah, I know. You can lie and get away with it, but...
Alrighty. Dash 4 amendments. Sean, do you want to speak to it, or do you have anybody that wants to go up here? Nope. Zippo, thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
I'm assuming that these amendments are the result of...
If you'll recall, we did have a public hearing on the Dash 3 amendments to this bill on 5/28/03, and there was extensive testimony at that time with the Dash 3 amendments that are substantially the same as what you're hearing today with some modifications. I did ask the groups, the interested parties, to get together and try to begin some discussions about how they might resolve the issue. Mr. Joseph was asked to facilitate that, and it's a combination of things. Due to the fact that time is running out, time is of the essence with respect to this session, the chair wants to move this bill along, so I asked Mr. Joseph to construct the best possible amendments that he could, given his legal mind, and we would hopefully move this thing across to the other chamber. We might hope that it would go to Representative Williams' committee, and Representative Williams' committee would put the finishing touches on it.
Well, Mr. Chairman, there are two things I like about this. One is that it gives us hope of getting some of these messes cleaned up sooner rather than later. And it also, I was concerned about the fairness in situations where people were self-insured for a period of time, and that appears to be addressed by these Dash 4 amendments, and I'm sure this is still a work in progress, but I'd be happy to move it along if that's what you want to do, if somebody
right.
else wants to speak.
So, Senator Burdick moves the adoption of the Dash 4 amendments to Senate Bill 297. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Thank you very much. Discussion on the motion. Senator Walker.
Well, I just see my little note in here, and I love it. There is a chain of command in the court system. The Supreme Court trumps the circuit court. I'm reminded by that discussion that we had earlier. So I think the bill should move forward.
All right, further discussion. Senator Ringo, you'd like to add some civil penalties, treble damages?
I would just make a comment that this bill, its original form, was intended to protect consumers and is now intended to protect Schnitzer Steel, which I'm fine with, but I just that's the way things go around here.
Okay.
It is, Mr. Chair, it is in the, I pointed out to Senator Ringo on page 8 that nothing in this act shall be construed to require the retrying of any finding of fact by a jury on a case that was done before this act was passed. So we're not going backwards.
Right, and the chair doesn't discriminate against which consumers, either corporations or persons. Other. Okay. Any further discussion? Any objection to the motion? There's no objection to the motion. The motion passes.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
First of all, I wanted to express appreciation to the Legislative Council, which did a lot of hard work on a very short notice on this compromise. And with that, I would move Senate Bill 297 as amended to the Senate floor for the due pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick now moves Senate Bill 297 as amended to the floor of the Senate for the due pass recommendation. Discussion. Senator Walker.
Since Senator Burdick is giving thanks, I just wanted to recognize for the record, I did read that a member of the Schnitzer family passed away. And since this is a bill about the Schnitzer family, I just wanted to offer my condolences.
All right. Any further discussion? Any objection to the motion? No objection. Motion passes. Any volunteers? I'll carry it. Thank you. We have one other really fun bill coming up here. 3329, public hearing. Council, what does this bill mean?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 3329B. I also, again, believe that we did have some testimony on this bill, but it's another Attorney General's bill. And just as a point of, I guess, expression of a conflict of interest, this morning Craig and I were commuting to work, and Craig was in the wrong lane and needed to get over, had his turn signal on, and Mr. Neely refused to let Craig in and pass by as if he didn't even see us.
Oh, wow.
House Bill...
What was the public hearing?
That's aggressive.
House Bill 3329 is from the Attorney General's office. It allows the Attorney General to initiate, participate, and prepare for efforts to assist and deliver services to individuals traumatized by acts of mass violence. Essentially, this allows the AG's office to participate in recovery efforts, assist survivors of both natural and man-made disasters. There was extensive discussion in the House about whether this bill was necessary and why it was felt that this bill was necessary given the broad authority that the AG's office already has. But it was the testimony of the folks from the AG's office that they did feel that this specific authority was necessary to effectuate the actions that they wanted to take. The bill also does a number of other things, generally because of its relating clause, and one of them that you will hear shortly is the no-call issue, and you will have before you, should have before you, dash B6, B7, B8, and B9 amendments, all of which address that issue. I understand that there are people here to testify, and indeed I have almost a full page of folks.
Excellent. Ms. Gallagher, Connie Gallagher, Department of Justice. And I don't know if you want to bring the Honorable Attorney General up with you and others, whomever. I apologize for making you wait.
My time is your time, Mr. Chair.
A couple of miscellaneous things to take care of.
Actually, very interesting. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, Hardy Myers, Attorney General. I'm here on behalf of House Bill 3329, which, as the Council's review has just indicated, has three discrete and unrelated parts, all, however, pertaining to the Department of Justice. In a few moments, Connie Gallagher will comment briefly further on the crime victim services portion. Kate Richardson of the Treasurer's Office and Fred Boss will be commenting on the provisions dealing with representation of the state as a lead plaintiff in securities class action litigation. And I want to address my comments to the no-call provisions of the bill, because those form, in my judgment, the heart of the bill. Mr. Chair, members, we have a very straightforward situation that we have to face in Oregon, and here is the situation. First of all, the no-call program is one of the most popular and successful consumer protection undertakings in the history of our state, and we have about 150,000 Oregonians who have now registered for the program. And we have been extremely diligent in our enforcement efforts. We have to date mounted 216 separate enforcement proceedings based on complaints of violations from registered Oregonians. Now, the creation of no-call programs in multiple states, I think, inevitably led to an incentive or an impetus to create a national list, so as to avoid the issues created by these multiple programs, issues for the telemarketers, particularly in terms of obtaining the lists and trying to comply with them. And Congress's authorization to create that national list has, by the FTC, will be implemented very shortly, beginning on the West Coast and in July. Now, incident to the Federal Trade Commission's rolling up to the start of the federal program, the creation of the national registry, which will be at no cost to any consumer. The Federal Trade Commission was toying with the idea of preempting all of the state plans. And by dint of a lot of hard work and lobbying with the FTC, both directly with Chair Muris, and I participated in at least one of those discussions, and a lot of staff-to-staff lobbying, and Ms. Pellegrini here was one of the most active state attorneys working staff-to-staff with the FTC, we were able to convince the FTC, at least at this time, not to proceed on a preemption basis. But to proceed with the creation of the national registry while leaving each of the states that has a no-call program free to enforce its own laws according to their provisions and to exert the remedies that their particular state law provides for violation. And that is a critically significant piece of this, because while state attorneys general are authorized under the national legislation to enforce violations of the national registry, the remedies under federal law, which in a preemption situation would be all that my office could enforce, the remedies under federal law do not include any recovery of costs for the states. So our practical ability to enforce violations would probably essentially disappear because we couldn't afford the resource drain. We have been able to mount our aggressive enforcement campaign because we have been able to compel violators to pay the costs of those proceedings as part of the settlement. And that's just that simple. So again, preemption in effect means the end of effective protection of Oregonians, in my judgment, because the federal remedies we simply won't be able to afford to enforce. It is critical we keep our state remedies. So we are thus positioned on the outset of the federal program. We have the Federal Trade Commission agreeing not to preempt, thereby leaving the states free to enforce their individual state laws according to their own state remedies, but the condition, if you will, or the understanding is that the states are going to amalgamate their lists into the federal registry, and we are going to wind up with one national list, free of charge, one place where telemarketers can go to get the particular lists they need, and at a much less cost to them than is now the case in many states. And if that amalgamation occurs, the FTC, I'm confident, will continue to be in the no preemption position that it's in now. If, on the other hand, the states continue to operate separate lists, I'm going to represent to the committee that preemption is virtual certainty. We have been able to forego preemption to this point because we have been able to convince the FTC the states would make a good faith effort to achieve an amalgamated list, a single list. Now, all this bill asks you to do is to authorize me to designate the federal list as the state list. That will become the Oregon list. We will transfer all of the names of the Oregon registrants into the federal list, and the bill further directs that any future applications into our program will be put into the federal list. That's what the bill does. The passage of this bill, Mr. Chair and members, is, I think, absolutely essential to avoid ultimate federal preemption. But it also achieves, in any event, a win-win situation. It's a win for Oregon consumers because the federal list is free. They don't have to pay a penny to get both the federal and, so long as there's no preemption, the state protection of our own law. Not a penny. The cost of the obtaining of the lists is much less for telemarketers, as I mentioned earlier. They have a one-stop shopping opportunity, if you will, and I think that's a lot of the incentive behind the federal legislation. It was to halt this balkanization of the no-call requirements for getting the lists all around the country and get all of that centralized in one place. And most importantly, again, we retain the ability to enforce our state laws according to our state, our own provisions of law, and our own remedy structure. So, Mr. Chair and members, I most respectfully urge the committee to approve the provisions of 3329 that will permit us to interface our program with the impending Federal Registry to the great benefit of our individual citizens, telemarketers, but particularly our citizens, in that they can both get a free program and we continue to be able to enforce our own state law in the very vigorous way that we have. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Myers. Senator Walker, questions?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Myers, I have a couple of questions. I'm struck by the fact that you have indicated that consumers can sign up for the Federal List for free, and yet on the news last night in my home, I heard them say that you had extended the deadline for signing up for Oregon's List to this Friday. That's what my news had reported, so that people could pay $6.50 to sign up for the Oregon List, when, by all intents and purposes, if we pass this bill, there's no need for an Oregon List anymore, is there?
Chair, Senator Walker, I think the deadline you're referring to is the deadline to get on to the next telemarketing report out of the Oregon system. In other words, those issue every quarter, Cheryl. And so the deadline was, if you want your name on the list that is going to issue, that Oregon system will provide telemarketers on July 1st, if you want to be on that list, you have to register into the Oregon program by this Friday. Right now, we are operating with two systems. And that announcement actually was one. Is that one that can,
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, I'm not sure that the I don't know that the department issued a press release other than to note that the deadline for the list was June 10th. I think that other information may have been provided by Oregon's List Administrator. I assume that they'll be testifying and you may want to ask them. But the fact of the matter is that at this point, the Oregon Attorney General's Office cannot tell citizens anything other than there is a state list. And in order to be included on the state list, there's a fee and there's a deadline. Unless and until House Bill 3329 passes, that's the way it's going to be in Oregon. If an Oregonian signs up for the federal list, when that list opens, when the registry opens on July 1st, by signing up for the federal list without 3329, they will only be on a federal list. They will not be on the state list, and they will not enjoy any of the protections under Oregon state law. So the newscast is an accurate reflection of the state of the law now.
All right. My second question is, Mr. Myers, you said that the government worked hard, worked with the FTC to not preempt state law. So how is it that state law is not preempted if people are signing up for a federal list? I mean, we're no longer going to have an Oregon list. Is that correct? We're going to give them our list and meld and become this one holy list. And then how do we still have authority to prosecute under this one giant holy list now?
Chairman, Senator Walker, we had authority simply because the legislature designates the Federal Registry, or allows me to designate the Federal Registry, as the Oregon list. That's the list component of the total structure. And our underlying state law with regard to who's exempted from the requirements of not calling and what are the remedies for violations, all of that stays in place. So we have a national list as a overarching piece of this structure, but each state's own individual laws, including remedies, stay in effect.
Okay.
Preemption supplants all of that state structure completely.
Thank you for that. And then my third and final question is, by buying into this federal list and basically getting rid of the Oregon list, are we also losing the benefit of the income that comes into Oregon businesses for facilitating that list?
Chair Menas, Senator Walker, the income that comes into the program would ultimately cease coming into the program because enrollment will be free. As it happens, I think the overwhelming majority of the money that Oregonians pay into this program is exported to Georgia, where the headquarters of the company involved are. I think less than something around 20% of this income may stay in Oregon. You'll keep a lot more money in the Oregon economy by getting us to the point where we end the Oregon Oregon program while still maintaining the Department of Justice's ability to enforce violations. Others can answer with more specific detail about what portion of the hundreds of thousands of dollars that come out of Oregonians' pockets actually stay in Oregon. But it's my understanding it's not more than 20%. Compared to Georgia.
Thank you for those responses to my questions. I just have serious concerns. Whenever the federal government gets involved in something, they seem to screw it up. They couldn't even get a tax cut right recently. So I just have lots of eyebrows being raised in my mind. Thank you.
Chair Minister, could I add just one thing? Senator Walker, I understand the sentiment, and I have... I, too, you know, as a state attorney general, am very sensitive about federal-state relationships and federal intrusion into state realms of policymaking. Very sensitive about that. And in this instance, however, I hope the committee will view the actions of the federal government, that is to say the creation of the national list, accompanied by the no preemption posture, as a really positive step forward. It will permit both federal and state protection of our citizens without cost in entering the program and preserve in full our enforcement mechanisms. So this is one instance where, so long as they maintain their present preemption position, they've got it right. They've done a good thing.
All right, Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When people get on the Oregon no-call list, they pay $6.50 to sign up for the first time, and then they pay $3 a year for renewal. Where does that money go?
Chair, would you like to describe that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, for the record, my name is Cheryl Pellegrini, Assistant Attorney General with the Oregon Department of Justice, assigned to the Financial Fraud and Consumer Protection Section. When you or I call or sign up via the internet or mail to get on the list, we mail our check to Georgia. That's where a check goes. Your question is how much comes back to Oregon, and
My question is what is the $6.50 pay for?
It pays for the private contractor that is currently under contract with the Attorney General to maintain the database of state phone numbers. So to do the actual registration process, adding numbers to the list, removing numbers from the list, and then selling the list on a quarterly basis to telemarketers who wish to telemarket into the state. That's what the money pays for. It does not pay anything towards the enforcement of the program.
That's correct. Now, when you say they sell it to the telemarketers, who gets the money when they sell it?
The list administrator.
Okay, so they get the $6.50 to sign people up, and then they get the proceeds from selling it to telemarketers.
Mr. Chair, Senator Burt, that's correct. They were getting $120 a year, and it went up to $250 recently.
So these functions, if it went to the federal list, these are the functions that Oregon consumers no longer would be paying for. They'd get on the federal list for free, but it's just a list. That's all you're paying for with your $6.50. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, that is correct.
Now, how do you pay for your enforcement?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, under state law, when we enforce our state law currently, telemarketer calls a phone number on the list. the Attorney General's office will pursue the violating telemarketer under the state's Unlawful Trade Practices Act, because a violation of the state no-call law constitutes a violation of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. That act allows us, among other things, to shift the cost of our enforcement efforts, investigation, and attorney fees from the Attorney General's office onto the telemarketer. So we make the offenders pay for the enforcement of the program. And as Attorney General Myers mentioned, to date we've taken 216 enforcement actions, and the primary assistant Attorney General is in the audience with us. I think that she probably has more to file, and it's netted, I believe, over 278,400.
Okay, if we consolidate our list with the federal list, which would be free, is there anything that would change about your enforcement mechanism?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, no. Everything would stay the same. The only thing that House Bill 3329 changes is who's taken the registration and selling the list. That is the only thing that changes. Everything else stays the same.
Thank you. And I also had a question. The federal list has some exemptions that Oregon law does not have. For example, they exempt telemarketing by banks, which is allowed under the federal system, not under Oregon system. So whose law would prevail?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, so long as with the assumption is House Bill 3329 passes, Oregon law, all the exemptions and all the inclusions under Oregon law apply. I think what you're referring to is the Federal Trade Commission only has jurisdiction over certain industries. It does not have jurisdiction over common carriers, all the telecommunications companies, and financial institutions. Oregon does. So as long as we can enforce our state law, we can continue to enforce the law against any of those entities that telemarket in violation of the no-call law.
Okay, so to sum it up, from the consumer standpoint, this has been a very successful program in Oregon. From the consumer standpoint, the only difference they would see if these lists were combined is they would no longer have to pay $6.50 a year or $3 upon renewal. Is that the only change the consumer would see?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, that is correct. And they would call a different phone number, or they would sign up on the FTC website instead of on the Oregon no-call website.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Question, Senator Ringo.
Thanks for coming this morning. I was especially interested in the comments that it's likely that if we do not pass this, we will have federal preemption, in which case we won't be able to enforce as we do now. And I was wondering how you know that. I mean, can you describe why you are confident that federal preemption is around the corner if we don't pass the bill?
Chair Menace, Senator Ringo, for myself, that's based on conversations with the FTC directly. I think that Cheryl can amplify further, because that has been the substance of much of that discussion that we've had, either AG to FTC chair level or staff to staff.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, preemption has come up now in two different venues. It first came up when the Federal Trade Commission announced that it was thinking about amending its telemarketing sales rule to create a national do not call registry. It sought comments from the state and it opened a rulemaking period. The 50 states' attorneys general, through the National Association of Attorneys General, participated in this process. The main topic of conversation initially with the FTC was whether or not the rule that it was contemplating would completely preempt the existing 27 state no-call laws. The FTC took the position that under the enabling legislation, which is the Telemarketing Fraud and Consumer Protection Act of 1994, that enabling legislation provided the FTC with authority to totally preempt the states. We, the National Associations of Attorneys General, essentially convinced the FTC to not pursue preemption at that level. And their language, if you look at their statement of basis and purpose for the promulgation of the Act, says that the FTC reserves preemption at this time. So that's the first cue. That was the first indication we received. The second indication came in January of this year. After the rule was promulgated, became effective December of 2002, it had to be funded. So the FTC sought funding through Do Not Call Implementation Act, Public Law 108-8. That law, it provides a mechanism for the FTC to establish a fee schedule to collect money from telemarketers to support the program, provide seed money of $16 million to get it up and running, and also provides reporting requirements. The conference committee that considered this act had conversation, and the conversation is reflected in the committee report, where committee members doubted the FTC's ability to achieve a single national registry absent total preemption of all state laws. And one of the reporting requirements, it's required to report annually at the end of the fiscal year, starting this year, which is after September 30. So this fall, it will report to Congress, and it will be telling Congress they will give it an analysis of its success in creating a single list. And part and parcel of that, we've been informed by FTC at the staff level that what that will include is a list of the states that either have chosen not to or not or are not able to designate the federal list as the state list. And from that conversation at the committee level, as Attorney General Myers pointed out, again, it's clear to us that Congress is certainly reserving the right to revisit the issue of preemption if this doesn't go as it's anticipated.
Thank you. Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I mean, just a comment. I think that's the explanation why we have to pass the bill. If that's preempt, and it's like they would, we need our no comments.
All right, other questions, discussion? You got other persons that want to cover?
Ms. Gallagher next, if we could.
Actually,
yes.
I'm sorry. Can I say one more thing?
Yes, of course.
I'm sorry. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there are a number of amendments to this bill before you. I know there are amendments, Senator Burdick's amendments, the Dash V8s. My comments do not pertain to those. The Dash 9s, B9s, or the department's amendments, we would not be pursuing those at this point. But I do want to address the Dash B7s. I'm not sure, but the Oregon Telecommunications Association, which is part of the private contractor that currently runs our list, submitted those. I assume that they still are a live issue. I would just like to say that passage of the Dash B7s alone will not do anything for us. In fact, it will seal our fate, because the only thing that the B7s do is they give the list administrator the discretion to share the Oregon list with the FTC. In a conversation as recently as yesterday afternoon with FTC staff, we've been advised that if a state cannot tell the FTC that it will designate the federal list as the state list when the registry opens in that state, then the FTC will not accept the import of any data from a state list at all. So what the B7s would do would be to ensure that Oregon will continue to have two lists. We will have to have two lists, and we will be on the list of states that are non-compliant when the FTC reports to Congress this fall. So it's the department's position that the committee should, that we would ask the committee to please not consider the B7s in connection with this bill at this point.
All right. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Bray.
If I could just get one other question on the record regarding the B8 amendments, which would put business lines and make business lines eligible for the Oregon no-call list with exemptions. The federal list currently does not allow business numbers. It does not cover business numbers. It only covers private numbers. What would happen if we pass the B8 amendments? Would we be able to put business lines on the federal list and use those in our enforcement if they were part of state law?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, we would. What would happen is if the VA's pass along with House Bill 3329, businesses could sign up on the federal registry. If they were then telemarketed in violation of Oregon law, we would have a remedy under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. However, there would be no remedy under the Federal Trade Commission's telemarketing sales rule.
That's correct. So that would be just exactly the same if we had our own standalone list. Is that correct?
Well, because it would be added to provisions of Oregon law, we would still be enforcing Oregon law, then they would be protected.
But it would not be banned from being included on the federal list.
They would not, Senator
Burdick. Thank you.
Okay. Senator Walker, I sense a question.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm confused about that because if we no longer have an Oregon list and you now register with the federal government, how can a business register with the federal government when they don't allow for that exemption or protection under their law?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, maybe if change the phrasing, it might make more sense. It's not that we're going to not have an Oregon list anymore. It's just that the Oregon list is going to be administered by a federal agency instead of a private list administrator. Everything else stays the same.
I understand that, Ms. Pellegrini, but when people sign up, who are they, after July 1, if we pass this bill, mm-hmm. where are they going to sign up? Who's going to sign them up?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, the sign-up will be automated. You'll call a telephone number. You'll leave your telephone number on a message center, or you'll sign up via the Internet at the Federal Trade Commission's website. The number will go on the list.
And there will be no exclusion. You call that number, go to the federal website, and you're a business, and you sign up your number. They're not going to kick your number out of there because you're a business? Is that what you're saying?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, that is correct. The only thing that would happen if you're a business and you sign up on the list, mm-hmm. the federal protections don't apply to you.
But the Oregon protections are stronger than the federal protections anyway. So
and they apply
really
as
no
long
difference.
As we can keep enforcing our
I
state
see.
Law.
The other question I have about that, however, is that you talk about the great joy in the telemarketers being able to just go and get one list to make it simpler for them, but I don't think this is simpler because they're not only going to have to get one list, but they're also going to have to make sure they're in compliance with each state's separate law. Would that not be true?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, that is correct. Most of the state no-call laws, the difference is only in the exemptions.
Okay.
Basically.
Chairman, Senator Walker, if I could add, the federal law, in my opinion, as it presently stands, is a compromise in terms of an overall push to get a single registry with a single set of exemptions and a complete supplanting of the states. It's a compromise in the sense that at least there will be a federal central registry, one registry, instead of 27 or 30 or whatever. But the other part of the compromise is the states get to keep their individual laws in terms of who's exempt and their enforcement mechanisms. It's a good compromise, frankly, from the standpoint of the people of Oregon, in my opinion.
Right, thank
win-win.
You. Mr. Myers. And
thank you very much.
Connie Gallagher, I think you're next up. Talk about your part of the bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Connie Gallagher, Administrator of the Crime Victims Assistance Section for the Oregon Department of Justice. And I'm happy to say that I'm here today just to speak to Sections 1 and 2 of the bill, and they're somewhat less complicated than the other portions of this bill. Sections 1 and 2 provide for the explicit authority for the Department of Justice to prepare for and respond to incidents of mass violence. Since the Thurston school shooting and 9/11 and other national incidents of mass violence, we have all been brought to the point where we realize that we need to plan for and prepare for not just an individual's physical safety and the treatment of their physical injuries, but we also need to plan for the psychological trauma that victims or witnesses to mass violence experience. This may include an array of short and longer-term supportive services that we feel will be helpful to individuals in restabilizing their life. The services may include one-on-one crisis intervention services, group crisis intervention services, educational efforts with our fellow professionals or public groups on the anticipated aftermath of an incident of mass violence. It also is likely to include assisting victims with the difficult tasks that they will encounter as they attempt to access services and resources. It will also include working with local leadership and professionals in order to assist them in planning for the future needs of their communities. Crime Victims Assistance Section would be part of a response effort due to our authority to administer the Crime Victims Compensation Program. However, this bill provides the explicit authority for us to work in partnership with others in order to build what is a new aspect of Oregon's response, and that's the behavioral health response capacity for our state. Crime victims and others have been actively working with the Office of Emergency Management, along with the Red Cross and along with the Department of Education, since the Thurston shootings, in order to build what was originally termed the Oregon Crisis Response Team Alliance. These efforts have proceeded informally, but our growing imperative to proceed quickly with the planning and preparation calls for greater clarity in regards to the role of the Crime Victims Assistance Section. This bill is what would provide the necessary authority for us to proceed with the planning and training efforts that are underway currently in a very informal manner. The reality is that should a large-scale incident occur, it would be impossible to withhold crisis intervention services at a location where the people who are in attendance are in crisis. The response can be provided through a thoughtful, planned process with trained volunteers, or we can see it done in a random, haphazard manner. This bill asks for your support to provide an opportunity for the Department of Justice Crime Victims Assistance to proceed with the training, collaboration, and the delivery of services that will result in a positive contribution towards stabilization and recovery of Oregon citizens should there be an incident of mass violence. Thank you very much. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you.
Thank you.
Fred Boss, Steph? Bad handwriting. Kate Richardson. You know what? Our chairman, he wanted to ask some questions of you two. I wonder if we might skip ahead and take Brant Wolf from the Oregon to tell me. Would you mind waiting?
Yeah,
I
have
questions on the points you're going to address. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Good morning, Senator Burdy, members of the committee. My name is Brant Wolf, representing the Oregon Telecommunications Association, and we are the private list administrator for the Oregon Do Not Call program. I've had the opportunity to visit with each one of you about this bill and the objections we have to the bill. I'd like to talk about the -B7 amendments, if I could. The issue of preemption, I think, is what has been driving the Department of Justice effort to move the administration of the program out of the state of Oregon and away from the Oregon Telecommunications Association. In my opinion, the -B7 amendments takes away that threat or that fear of preemption. The -B7 amendments would allow the OTA to share our list with the Federal Trade Commission. The Department of Justice indicated that the permissive language would be a problem. We'd be more than happy to change that in our amendments and make it mandatory if that's the case. And we have every intention of sharing our list if the Dash B7s are passed. But if it's a problem, we can do that by mandate. By way of background, there wouldn't be a do not call program in the state of Oregon if it weren't for the OTA. This is our program. We shepherded this legislation through the process and got it signed into law in 1999. We've been the list administrator since the beginning of the program, and we're pretty proud of it. No one has more at stake with this program than the OTA, and no one would be more disappointed in Federal Trade Commission preemption of the program than the OTA. That's not our intent at all, and we believe the Dash B7s satisfies any threat of preemption whatsoever and maintains not only enforcement of the program but the administration of the program here in Oregon. Along those lines, there's been some points raised about the funds generated by this program. The OTA is the private list administrator. We have a subcontract with a company in Georgia that administers these kinds of programs all over the country. They are an expert at this type of thing, and when we had to get a, when the OTA needed to find someone to administer the list, they were the natural people to go to. The OTA earns some revenue from this. It's not a ton of money. It averages about $113,000 a year so far. That's money that we earn and spend here and pay taxes on here in the state of Oregon. Before I proceed any further, are there any questions about the Dash B7 amendments at all?
Madam Chair.
Senator Ringo.
I mean, the Attorney General emphatically stated that the Dash 7 amendments would make Oregon out of compliance. It's pretty hard for me to ignore such a statement.
Senator Burdick, Senator Ringo, that was the first I heard of that, actually, this morning in their testimony. I'm not sure what they were getting at. And maybe Ms. Pellegrini could flesh this out a little bit. Is the issue the permissive part of the language of sharing the list? It's my understanding that the FTC expects harmonization with state programs. Absolutely. That's always been the expectation.
Just to follow up on this case. Sure. I mean, I'm not sure. Maybe we need to ask the Attorney General's office again. But when they emphatically state the Dash 7 amendments would make Oregon out of compliance, that's a serious issue for me. And that, to me, that makes the Dash 7 a non-starter. Absolute non-starter. I don't want Oregon to be out of compliance. Now, if you can work with the Attorney General's office to somehow reach some agreement, and if it's the permissive language, if it's something else, that's fine. But I certainly can't support the Dash 7 amendments if they would make it so that Oregon's not compliant.
Chairman and Senator Ringo, I wouldn't expect you to. That's not the intent of the Dash 7 amendments whatsoever. The intent of the Dash B7 amendments is to allow us to share the list with the Federal Trade Commission and do away with the threat of preemption. The OTA has no interest in preemption. The issue, as I understand it, has always been harmonization. The Dash B7s allow us to harmonize our state program with the Federal Trade Commission program by sharing every subscriber with the Federal Trade Commission. That was the intent of the Dash B7s. If that's somehow not the case, we would be certainly happy to amend that, to change that.
Thank you.
Senator Wolf.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Wolf, I think my notes indicate when Ms. Pellegrini was testifying that her concern was the discretionary language, the may instead of a shall. I don't know if putting a shall in there will fix that for her, but that question should be asked. But I have to ask this question, and you know it's coming because others have talked about it. If we maintain an Oregon list and people are paying $650 to belong, and then there's a federal list where they just call a federal number and they sign up for free, how are we going to meld the two lists, and why would someone continue to pay $650? I mean, you've done a fabulous job, and I agree with you, but why would someone continue to pay $650 when they can do it for free?
Well, if there are two separate lists, then clearly the Oregon Do Not Call program is much more stringent in as far as who can and cannot call you than the Federal Trade Commission list. There's no doubt is that. So that's why anybody, any particular person concerned with telemarketers would continue to sign up with the Do Not Call program in Oregon.
But, Mr. Wolf, Ms. Pellegrini, in response to my question, I think it was actually Attorney General Myers who said that even though you sign up for the federal list, the telemarketer still has to understand Oregon law and Oregon exemptions and still follow those. So there's a problem here in tracking what you're saying. And, I mean, I don't mean to put you on the spot.
No.
Because I really support this program, and I really do want it to stay in Oregon, but I'm having problems with that part of it as well.
Chairman, Senator Walker, I'm sure there will be confusion as of July 1 when the Federal Trade Commission program becomes effective, and there will be some kind of push to get people to sign up. Be that as it may, the fact of the matter is, if you sign up as an Oregonian on July 1st with the Federal Trade Commission list and no other list, you will not be covered in many, many instances. You have to maintain your coverage through the Oregon Do Not Call program. And that won't change no matter who. If you pass 3329, as I understand it, I guess the lists would be shared in some fashion between the two programs. I don't know if I'm answering your question or not.
Well, your testimony that I've just heard now is that if Oregonians don't sign up for the Oregon list as well as the federal list, then they won't have coverage under Oregon law. Is that what you're testifying?
My testimony should be that if you don't sign up for the Oregon Do Not Call program, you will not enjoy the same benefits that you would if you signed up only under the Federal Trade Commission program.
Okay. That's what I thought I heard you say. So I think, Mr. Chair, I'm going to need to have the AG's office respond to that to make sure that what Mr. Wolf is saying is their they agree with that interpretation. And I don't think Mr. Wolf is misrepresenting anything. That's his belief, and I want to make sure that that works with what you're saying.
Chair Senator Walker, for the record, my name is Cheryl Pellegrini. Thank you. Here's the issue. If we cannot, on July 1st, tell the FTC, not that we're going to share our list with them, that is not the issue, but if we cannot designate the FTC registry to be the state no-call list, that's the critical piece. That is what the B7s will delete from House Bill 3329. It takes away the Attorney General's ability to designate the federal list to be the state list. It replaces it with a provision that would give the list administrator the discretion to share the list. But if you can't designate the registry, the federal registry to be the state registry, it's not going to do us a bit of good to share the list, because the FTC, when they roll out the program in July 1, depending on whether or not 3329 passes, there will be one of two messages to Oregonians. They'll either say the Oregon Attorney General's office has designated the state list to be has designated the federal registry to be the state list. If you're on the state list, you don't have to do anything, because your number will automatically be added to the federal registry. It's all taken care of. If House Bill 3329 does not pass, then the message to Oregonians is going to be, if your number is on the state list and you've paid $6.50 or $3, your number will not be included on the federal registry. If you want to be on the federal registry, you will have to sign up separately. And if you sign, and here's the other thing, if you sign up separately for the federal registry, you will not get any of the protections under Oregon law, because we've not designated that registry to be our list.
What, Ms. Pellegrini, what, however, if Mr. Wolf changes the may to a shall, does that
Mr.
solve
Chair, Senator
that
Walker,
problem?
It does not. Whether or not the list administrator can share the data is not the issue. The issue is whether or not the Attorney General's office can say the federal list is going to be our list now. Furthermore, it's our opinion that if you were to pass 3329, you don't need the authority in the dash B7s. We already have it inherent. If we're going to designate the Federal Registry to be our list, we have the inherent authority to tell the list administrator to import or to give all of the numbers currently on the state list to the feds. I mean, that authority is already there. So,
Chairman and Senator Walker, I understand the issue now. I was not aware of this. This is information that's new to me.
Have you guys actually gone out in a big conference and talked and tried to catch your difference?
We've talked ad nauseum, actually. And this what Cheryl is sharing here today is news to me. I thought if we could share the list, and we, mandatory or not, I mean, if we shared our list, if we harmonized our list with the Federal Trade Commission program, then the threat of preemption goes away. And what I'm hearing today is that we voluntarily preempt it, or they're going to preempt it anyway. That was not my understanding of the situation.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we've spoken. I think that this is a sort of a complicated issue, and I think that maybe and perhaps through lack of trying, I have failed to communicate this, but I mean, the whole reason that that House Bill 3329 says what it says is because that's what needs to happen. It's not an issue of sharing lists. It's an issue of designation. And that's always been our position. Now, I can tell you that the position of the Federal Trade Commission has changed because they have become less willing to accommodate states who are going to delay purposefully in making the designation. Remember, too, as I'm sure you're aware, that we're a state that has a legislature that only meets every other year. While there may be other states that are that are waiting until the first of next year, and they've already made arrangements, but that's not the position that we're in. So the FTC's position for us is if you can't tell us on July 1 when the registry opens in Oregon that you're going to designate the Federal Registry as a state registry, then we are not going to accept any information from your state registry into the Federal Registry. All those people are going to have to re-sign up for the Federal Registry, and there will be two lists in Oregon.
All right, Senator Ringo.
It just seems to me this is a situation where Mr. Wolf's organization has done a great job for the people of Oregon, but the world has changed. You know, the world has changed, and we need to adapt to that. And in order to do that, that means passing this bill. And it's hard to pass this bill in a way that accommodates the concerns of your organization. And I guess I feel a little bit bad about that, but on the other hand, I think our responsibilities are to the consumers of Oregon and the people who want a no-call list that is as meaningful as possible.
And the chair, actually, I get a little ticked off anytime the federal government starts telling us what to do. Just kind of a nature thing with me. I just think, sorry, I don't like that. But I personally have no opinion about this bill.
Can I change that?
I don't care. I don't really care about this bill. I don't. And, so I guess my admonition, notwithstanding Senator Ringo's comments, Cheryl, is there a way that you can write this thing that would alleviate some of the concern of the current parties, or is it just simply impossible to do?
Mr. Chair, what we have done, I don't think that we need legislation to do it. The current contract with the list administrator runs through January 14, 2004. We've been steadfast in our commitment to the list administrator that if 3329 passes, we've already told the FTC that we want our list administrator to be able to finish out their contract. If people want to continue to pay them, you know, and they'll take numbers and send them on to the FTC, the FTC will accept that if 3329 passes. Mm-hmm. There was a time when...
So write it in the bill.
We don't need that.
Well, I said you need it. Then you need it.
Okay.
If you want the bill.
What would you like us to...
Go out of the room, figure out how you can accommodate his interests, and come back.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you. With that, it's 10 o'clock, and we're adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.